Tonight on The Download, from the B-52's Cindy Wilson, the Cook County Bar Association's D'Artesia Pitt, and singer-songwriter Margaret Glaspie. Now, here's your host, a man who thinks we should call them the Loyola Ramblers, Justin Kaufman.
Yeah, bring that back, right? I feel like I spent most of last night watching the game with my dad, saying that's not how you say Loyola. My dad and a lot of dads out there are like, this is really great for Loyola. Really Loyoling it up. So why fight it, right? Why don't we embrace it as a city instead of trying to always say, oh, no, it's Loy, instead of lie. Let's just go with Loyola. It's more Chicago anyway, right? Loyola. Hey, everybody, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. This is our final show before spring break. What? We're off next week. And so tonight we change it up a little bit because, you know, we have so many things. March in Chicago is such a great time to go out and see great artists that are coming through, touring through Chicago. And it's also a great time for us to try and get them on the show. And as, you know, you start to book and put stuff together, you recognize quickly that you're running out of time. And so you put these requests in, and, oh, we'd love to talk with Cindy Wilson from the B-52s. And then they're like, yeah, we can do March 28th. You're like, yeah, we're going to be gone. So tonight, in lieu of doing the week in review or reloading the news, we determined tonight that we were going to just jam-pack this show. So there's no review. And to be honest, we talked about it in the production meeting, which is Pete and I. And it's not even a meeting. It's texting back and forth at 10:30 in the morning. You up? But we determined that you've got enough news. What are we going to talk about tonight? We would talk about the winners. I had to do the Illinois primary and be like, ugh, we've done 14 hours on the Illinois primary. Or, you know, Trump tweets like crazy. You know what? All right. There's plenty to talk about. We'll talk about it. We'll get to everything tonight. But tonight we have a jam-packed show, and we're going to squeeze it all in before our vacation next week. I don't even know where to start. I guess start with Cindy Wilson from the B-52s, celebrating this is her 40th anniversary of Rock Lobster. It's amazing to think that the band is four decades old. We'll talk with Cindy tonight. She's got a solo career going, and she continues to be a road warrior, and she is going to be at Beat Kitchen coming up next week. So she'll join us tonight to talk about her illustrious career, the B-52s, but also her solo career, which is a lot of contemporary dance music. But, I mean, I'd have to look closer. I will before the interview, but she's not necessarily the age you would think is into contemporary dance music. She just continues to defy nature and continues to be one of the more prolific entertainers of our time. So Cindy Wilson, the B-52s, that's tonight. Also, we have an unbelievable lineup. Margaret Glaspie is going to join us. If you're familiar with her, she's a singer-songwriter out of New York, by way of California and Boston. But she is a tremendous, tremendous talent. And she is going to be at Space coming up in April. And I'm so happy to have her. We're going to talk with her about her career. She has a new EP she just kind of dropped in the last 2 weeks. And we're going to have her on the show. That's awesome. David LaPepe is the frontman for the band Gang of Youth. Another band that just got announced that they're playing Lollapalooza, that came out this week. Just did Seth Meyers 2 weeks ago. Has an unbelievable following. Was an Australian city, Australian band that is now in London. But they're about to break. Anyone who's familiar with these names know that that's a huge band right now, Gang of Youth. Youths. David will be on the show a little bit later. Also, Vic DiBattista is the stand-up comedian. You may be familiar with him. He's a kind of an Italian-American jokester, stand-up. You know, it's a thing. He's got a great line where he says something about the fact that, you know you're Italian if you spend all the time in the basement. You know, we have this great house, three floors, but my family decides we all got to stay in the basement. I know my wife's family is Italian. I'm like, that's things every time we go over there. Let's go in the basement. But he became a huge viral sensation. This is a guy who'd been working 30 years in stand-up in New York and really toiling away, not finding any fame out of it, kind of being a stand-up of stand-up in the clubs in New York City, just trying to make it, living in New Jersey, gave up on it, did a little video for YouTube when Hurricane Sandy was coming where he wanted to go get bread and milk. And he was made a big deal. He, you know, oh, I gotta get the bread and milk. I gotta get the bread and milk, which became a meme. You probably know exactly what I'm talking about. A meme. It was watched like it became the biggest bit for Hurricane Sandy. It had like hundreds and hundreds of millions of hits. And it actually launched, it like became a second phase of this guy's career. He's now being booked. He's at the Park West coming up next week. It's like the little things that happen to you, especially if you're just working and toiling away in the clubs, like that, he's now on tour. Now he's in Kevin James's movies. He's this guy that's around all the time, all from a viral video that he put up about have to go get the bread and milk. That is it. I just did the bit for you. It's not like it was like, you know, when you have to go get the... No, he just made fun of the fact that he was like, oh, I gotta get the bread and milk. Someone told me to get the bread and milk. And that's it. It was a 20-second bit. And it relaunched his career. We'll talk to him tonight. Also, did we get it right with the Cook County judges? Tartesia Pitts will be back in studio. We talked to her right before the election about recommendations. And I want to follow up and find out if we did it right. Did judges that were not recommended get voted in? Did judges that were highly recommended get voted in? We'll talk with Tartesia about what we should take away from the election results on Tuesday. And then the download of Chicago business as well. So we got a lot to do tonight. So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic. I feel like I probably missed. Did I miss anything? I feel like I got. Oh, Kevin Powell. Cubs and Sox. I'm telling you, there's so much on tonight. We're going to do the baseball preview early. This weekend is the final weekend of spring training.
I'm not sure. Do you play fantasy baseball?
You know what? I dabble. 4 championships in 10 years, but I dabble.
I've recently been invited to join a fantasy baseball league, and I have never done it before. Sat next to you while you do it.
Yeah, and it's the most annoying thing ever. I feel so bad for Pete. Hey, Pete, you know what? It's so crazy what this third baseman for the Phillies is doing. He's hitting 1-for-4 tonight. I guess.
Can you sneak in, maybe ask Kevin, talk a little fantasy
can? He's going to have to ask me questions. I'm the expert.
Yeah, you're the champion.
I'm a 2-time champion, back-to-back. And it's not a slouch league. It's a league with a lot of baseball fans and experts. Real tough stuff. A lot of cheating from these guys. A lot of moving guys around at the last minute, taking them out of lineups, trying to fleece people on trades. It's a dog eat dog world out there. So I'm glad that I will accept the role of being a consultant on your team, Pete. I will accept it. Accepted. We're gonna kill your friends. And we're going to make them enemies. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Roger Badish tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break, come back, do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. I'm tempted to make the whole carry out just about the Loyola Ramblers. I'm sorry, the Loyola Ramblers. As they move on to the Elite Eight, one game away from the Final Four, and the team standing in their way is coached by the guy who took the last Illinois team to the Final Four. It's storybook-like! Bruce! And Sister Jean! And a bobblehead! And, well, we'll talk about it later in sports. The big news locally is that Mayor Emanuel and former police superintendent Gary McCarthy have decided that the best place for them to measure their anatomy would be in public during a mayoral campaign. Today, the mudslinging began with both campaigns trying to link each other to Donald Trump. Hey, newsflash, that crap's not going to work. You're running for mayor of Chicago. 6 degrees of Trump doesn't matter here. Talk about how you're going to pay for the mounting debt, make sure taxes don't keep going up, and crime! Your former police superintendent, crime! And maybe hot dogs, too. Throwing hot dogs. But mostly crime. Emanuel says McCarthy is buddy-buddy with Trump. McCarthy says Emanuel took money from Trump, which is rich guy buddy-buddy. But how about you both sit down and tell us what you knew and when you knew it about Laquan McDonald? Why don't we start there? Until then, no one cares about your puffy chest garbage, right? Also, McCarthy getting into this race has opened up a huge lane for someone else to win this thing. Joe Berrios, perhaps? I'm just throwing out rumors. I'm starting to think that President Trump loves drama. Yeah, just came to me. Started to think that. A spending bill was put together. It looked like we would have a prospect of a drama-free, government shutdown-free process. But Trump went to Twitter this morning and defied his own staff to say he might, capital letters here, he capped it, veto the bill because the Democrats have abandoned DACA recipients and haven't funded the wall enough. Boy, he playing. Not enough Trump in the news, maybe? I don't know what this is about. He got his wish, and once he was firmly above the other stories, like Craigslist shutting down its casual encounter section, maybe that's what it was. Like, I need to get above that story. Only then did he go ahead and sign the bill. Also, don't be confused. This wasn't about a budget nor a possible government shutdown, but it was more of a campaign strategy to get swing voters, particularly Latino voters, to think twice about voting for Democrats in the midterm. Because I'm sorry, didn't Trump and the entire world chastise the Dems for shutting down the government last time because of the non-budget related issue of protections for DACA? Remember that? Now Trump goes to Twitter acting like it's a loss that's not in there. What? That's upside down world once again. Again, boy, you playing. That's my new, I'm thinking about that being my catchphrase. What do you think? Boy, you playing. Also, pet peeve time on the White House. People are really buying into this fake news mantra, right? And how the papers are out to get the president. But just this week, H.R. McMaster and John Dowd are out. Okay? No big deal, right? But you know what? The papers had those stories last week. And the president and Sarah Huckabee Sanders went out of their way to call out the lying media for telling false and exaggerated stories. And that the media, once again, was wrong. But they weren't! Right? So to me, shows more of a sinister approach by the White House, which is to take every opportunity to call out the media, right or wrong, to sow the seeds of distrust. Evil much, right? That's like straight out of Dr. Evil. Again, boy, you playing. I don't think it's going to stick. Memes on the internet. Boy, you playing. Nothing's ever real. Kids are getting on buses making their way to D.C. this week for the big March of Our Lives. This was organized by the kids from Parkland to take on the issue of gun violence and imploring the government to do something to protect them while in schools, and in our case in Chicago, all around schools. The White House today said that they plan to introduce a plan to ban bump stocks, which seems like a no-brainer for a tragedy that happened 8 months ago. But does Congress have any interest in taking on the issue that is now? Kids marching all over the country to tell our leaders that they don't feel safe in their own schools. We'll see what happens. In weather, is it seriously going to snow this weekend? What? Possible 9 inches out west. That's it. I'm taking off for LA this weekend on a whim and not because it was planned for months. That's it. I'm out. In sports, the Loyola Ramblers. Let's take a moment to really embrace the greatness happening before our eyes. Small Chicago school. A mid-major that gets very little respect in this town. And here they are, winning over NBA recruits and conferences that pay their coaches and probably their players millions. So far, the Giant Slayers have beat the ACC, the SEC, and the Mountain West. Next, it's the Big 12, and if they take K-State down, probably going to get the Big 10 in the Final Four. What? It's so damn impressive. It really is. And they haven't beat mid-majors in this tournament. That Nevada team we dispatched last night, that's made up of a bunch of major program transfers. They're the UNLV of 2018. And they're doing it by playing great team basketball, smart basketball. Yesterday at one point in the second half, they were shooting 100% from the field. What? And they did it mostly by just getting uncontested layups because Nevada was trying to guard against three-pointers. It really was beautiful, smart basketball. Kudos to the kids at Loyola. Now Bruce Weber. Hard to not like Bruce Weber from his days taking the Illini to the title game, but yet I still don't. I don't know. I think it's the voice. But it has to be somewhat of a tough pill to swallow for our brethren in Champaign, right? Not only are they nowhere near the NCAA tournament, but they are now watching their ousted coach and a Chicago team play in their stead. This K-State team is tough, but they're beatable. They finished fourth in the Big 12 and showed toughness last night, although they took advantage of a Kentucky team where everyone played like they're 18 years old because, I don't know, they are. That big dude went to the free throw line like 25 times, and he made 8. Now, Kentucky wouldn't have even been in the game if it wasn't for that dude, but seriously, K-State, pretty lucky. Very excited for Saturday. Think about it. By Saturday night, we will know if the Loyola Ramblers are in the Final Four. Also, fun to watch the national media go crazy over Sister Jean. But then I also saw Kenny Smith. He kept calling it Loyola of Chicago. Is that how you say it? That's not how you say it. I guess we don't because we don't have to say of Chicago. You know, this Loyola of Chicago is a strong team. All right. It's Loyola. or Loyola. I'm hoping to hear Barkley say Loyola. I think that'd be great. The Bulls, let's talk about the NBA. The Bulls are steadily climbing down the standings. On Wednesday, the Bulls got beat at home by 33 points by the Denver Nuggets, and we didn't even hear a peep about it. This Bulls team under John Paxson and Gar Foreman, man, maybe the worst, I don't know, since Jalen Rose, Danielle Marshall, Elton Brand, Eddie Curry, Tyson Chandler. Ugh. I don't understand why the city of Chicago accepts this futility from one of the biggest franchises in the NBA. And on purpose. They aren't even subtle about tanking. They're taking our ticket money and tanking. They're currently the seventh worst, and they're within a game or two of moving up to the top five. So I guess there's something to cheer for. I guess if I had a chance to ask Gar Pax a question, it would be, what do you expect us, the fans, to do here? At least with the Blackhawks, there's a genuine feeling you get from management and the players that they let down the fans this year. They say it every time they talk. Not so with the Bulls. Not even close. And finally tonight, graffiti blasters destroyed a piece of street art at the Cards Against Humanity offices on Elston. The company commissioned a French artist to do a piece, ironically, of a hooded figure doing graffiti on the side of their building. Rumor has it that Streets and Sand was cleaning up graffiti more aggressive than usual leading up to the Amazon visit this week. I mean, it's so Grabowski. I can't even come up with a joke. While they're at it, I mean, can they graffiti blast other things, right? I don't want to speak for everyone, but nobody wants to see that Urlacher billboard anymore. Not even Amazon. Sorry, we thought it was graffiti. That's the carryout for March 23rd, 2018. It's going to snow this weekend, but it's too late to turn off the lemonade machine. You already turned it on. So we're just moving ahead with spring summer regardless. You're welcome. Coming up, download on Chicago Business here on 720 WGN, and also Cindy Wilson from the B-52s. Fun as that. What a great show tonight. Also talk Kevin Powell's coming up. So much to get to, so let's get to it. So download 720 WGN. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Yes, it's time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is a segment where we talk with CEOs and entrepreneurs. They tell their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, a company that was born in the Wicker Park neighborhood. If you live in the city, chances are you've had some sort of meal at Milk and Honey on Division. The cafe has been around since 2002. In that time, Carol Watson got to making her own house granola. The granola was such a hit that Watson started Milk and Honey Granola, which can now be found on the shelves of grocery stores nationwide. It's a great success story for a great Chicago businesswoman. Co-owner and CEO Carol Watson is in studio tonight to download in Chicago Business. Carol, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about your story, because it's really a two-pronged story. I mean, you have a background in culinary. You have been in restaurants. You were a server. You, Mia Francesca up on Clark Street. I love your story. But you started a cafe in Wicker Park in 2002. Talk us through what decisions you were making to start that cafe back then.
Well, a good friend of mine who was actually my opening business partner, her father-in-law had just bought the building, and I just got back out of culinary school, and we were kind of trying to figure out what I want to do, and she's like, you want to open a cafe? And I'm like, sure, why not? So we did, and funny story is we're like, nobody even knows we're going to open. We had paper on the windows. We decided to open on a Saturday. We had a line down the street, and this was just before the neighborhood had really turned, and we had to close the doors early because we had a guy on the slicer hand doing potato chips, and it was crazy, and it was good, and from the get-go, the cafe just took off.
Well, I've always loved Milk and Honey, and it's an area that when you talk about a cafe taking off like that, That's a business. That is a full-time business if you are going to run Milk and Honey, because like you said, there are lines around the corner every weekend to try and get into this space, and you know, there's a lot going on there. But that's not where you stopped. You were making a lot of great stuff in your cafe, including granola, and you recognized quickly that people wanted to take it to go.
They did. And that was never a plan to have a granola company, and we started making it in-house. People started asking if they could buy it to take home. So we kind of packaged it up. I think originally we had it in a mason jar, and then we had a little white bag. And naively, I went to Stanley's Produce with a couple of bags and said, hey, you want to buy this? And they picked it up. And from there, it just, and they started going through, which at the time was a huge amount, six cases a week or something like that. And we're like, wow, there's something to this. And it just kind of morphed into its own company. It was never planned, but it's been a really, really great thing.
As a businesswoman, as someone who had experience in the restaurant industry and wanted to start a cafe, and you had that happening, what was the moment that you recognized that you were this needed to be a business in its own right, the granola, that it had a chance to go bigger and further than what the restaurant could do?
I think that just the demand that people coming in the cafe loved it. We started making it because I couldn't find a good granola for the parfaits. So, it was an unintentional, as things often happen, for whatever reason, something comes out, good comes out of something that's unintended. And we just started, making it, and we, once again, kind of naively, didn't really know what we were getting into, and dropped it off to the Whole Foods corporate offices. And Jason Stein, who was the buyer at the time, loved it. And he was really a huge key for us, and he got us into the Whole Foods. They were doing a local push at the time. So a lot of things are just being in the right time at the right place, and I think really having a really good product, not to...
Well, I mean... At that point, take us the challenge. I mean, just the idea of getting it in the stores and to have the luck to get it into Whole Foods or even Stanley's. I mean, at that point, I just assume that this venture. What did you know about how to get product onto grocery store shelves? That to me, I would be like, maybe I need to go back to school. I wouldn't necessarily know what to do at that point.
We didn't. It's been a real learning curve, and there has been a lot of, there are times when you kind of want to cry because, you're trying to expand this, and there's things that are beyond your control that happen. And then some days are just, everything just flows and it's beautiful, and you're like, God, this is amazing. This is great that people love this. And, but it's, you just learn. It's not my background. And my director of operations, who is also an investor and a partner in the company, she's been running granola for me for 12, 13 years, and she's phenomenal. And, we've grown it, and we're actually in the middle of, we just got our non-GMO certification, and we're going to be doing a package change, kind of updating the package, and we're really excited about that. And then we want to take it to that next level.
Well, we'll talk about what it takes to the challenges of growth. In studio tonight, Carol Watson. She is the co-owner and CEO of Milk and Honey Granola and the Milk and Honey Cafe, which is at Division and Damon in Chicago. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More conversation on Download in Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. In studio tonight, Carol Watson. She's the co-owner and CEO of Milk and Honey, both the cafe and the granola. We're talking about that story, which the cafe started in 2002, and here we are in 2018. The cafe is still going strong, and the granola, which now, for Chicagoans, it's synonymous with Chicago. You can find the Milk and Honey granola in all the grocery stores here in town, but getting ready for another step, moving, you continue to grow with this company. Let me ask this. I guess as you get ready for the next level, and here comes a repackage and you're going to distribute even bigger, what are the lessons learned from the last times you had to take steps, when you had to move up the ladder or take the business to scale? What are some of the lessons you've learned as a businesswoman that you're going to apply to this newest challenge?
Well, we know that, our name, we've gotten out there really well and really with not a sales team. So that's kind of next on our agenda. I think that the one thing that's really gotten as far as with our product as it has is the fact that once people try it, I think they're repeat customers, which is, a huge thing. And we've never had really a sales force before. So that's kind of next on our plan, and just to kind of expand to some markets that maybe don't know we're out there yet. So, we're really strong in the Midwest. Ultimately, our goal is to be, more on the East Coast and West Coast. But right now, we're kind of happy. We don't want to double in growth. We want to, do it right and do it slow and do it methodically. And so, you know, we want to kind of saturate the Midwest a little bit more and then look at, you know, the rest of the country.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you're in an office on the near northwest side of Chicago. And I would assume that this is an age-old conversation with businesses as they try to scale, is this idea that at some point or another, if you want to be a player for the East Coast and West Coast, you're going to have to really up your production. Mm-hmm. And by upping production, changing the way maybe that you make the granola. I mean, there's a lot that goes into, and we've seen this from business and business as they grow into a much larger entity. Do you have to be mindful of that and mindful of not changing the recipe or not changing what got you there in the first place?
Absolutely. And that's something that we've talked about because if we don't want to affect the integrity of the product, and everything is hand-baked, and we literally have guys putting it in trays, pulling it out, and stirring it. And if we were to go the route of complete automation, we're slightly automated mm-hmm. with our filler and sealer, but it would change the product, and we don't want to do that. So I think we'd be happier growing slowly and doing it the right way instead of compromising the quality of it.
You were telling me right before we started that, you know, because you were at a different place and I saw that you moved, but even the little things, like as you got more businesses that wanted the product, that meant more big trucks that would come out, and the place you're at, you had the little things you had to think about is that the trucks couldn't get through the alley. They couldn't get down the street that you guys were located at. It's a little things like that when you're a homegrown Chicago company that you maybe didn't think about, you have to start thinking about.
Absolutely, because I remember our first big order with, I think it was with Whole Foods, or our first major distributor, and you know, they were ordering pallets, where before we were getting orders for cases, and we're like, oh, how are we going to do this? But literally, it filled up the whole space, which was a great thing. And then we were like, this, you know, if we want to grow, we're going to have to find a bigger space with a loading dock and you know, a forklift. And I know I was telling somebody, I never thought I'd own a forklift. I own a forklift.
Well, it's such the dichotomy, the balance, the contrast of the two companies, because Milk and Honey, the cafe, I mean, that is a community center. You walk in there and there are people waiting for tables, but it's the menu's on chalk on the board. It's hectic. It's crazy, but it's also a cafe. When you're talking about forklifts and pallets and loading zones and you know, going to scale and they're different. Talk about how do you, as a business owner, and you own both of these businesses, how do you make it happen? How do you deal with that contrast that they're different beasts?
Well, with the cafe, I feel more at ease with it, more comfortable with it, because it's my background. And now, because we're trying to take the granola to that next level, I'm backing off from the cafe and putting people in charge, trying not to micromanage so much so that I can help a little bit more over granola. And granola is, it's different in so many ways, and easier and difficult too. It's hard to explain, yeah. But they're two completely different, wonderful things.
Have you, I mean, as coming from the restaurant industry, did you have to change as an owner, as someone who's a co-owner and CEO, do you have to deal with the issues like micromanagement and how you deal with staff once you get to a point where you're not the person who's serving the food anymore?
Yes, but my staff is fabulous. Both at the cafe and granola, a lot of them have been with us for years. And, you know, you just have to kind of know that it's maybe not going to be perfect, but it's going to be 95%. And nothing's ever perfect. And you have to just give up that control. And they've earned my trust over the years, too. My kitchen guys have been with me for many, many years. Right. And they're just fantastic.
All right. My last question for you is really just about Chicago. I mean, this is a company you mentioned. You want to go East Coast. You want to go West Coast. But you have spent a huge amount of your career here in town. What is it about Chicago that keeps you here? And why is Chicago a part of the recipe of Milk and Honey?
I love Chicago. I moved here almost 30 years ago, and I just, you know, it's a just an amazing city. I have so many ties here, a lot of friends in the restaurant business, and I really love it. I think it's a great city, and, you know, it's funny. It's nice to see it grow and change over the years, and, you know, even coming downtown tonight, it makes me appreciate it, because sometimes I get stuck in my little circle over there, and I'm like, it's just an amazing city. Like, looking out this view right now is just
And great. For the great, yeah.
Yeah.
Carol Watson is the co-owner and CEO of Milk and Honey, both the granola company and the cafe. The cafe at Division and Damon, the granola you can find in grocery stores all over the Chicago area and soon to be on the East and West Coast. Carol, thanks so much for coming in and being my guest on the Download of Chicago Business. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
One ball, one strike, one out, one run. Ducky at the bat, kids, what he done.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, next week we got spring break, so we won't be here, which means we will miss the fun and the part I love most about Chicago spring is the previews of the baseball squads, the Chicago Cubs and Chicago White Sox. So we're doing it a little bit earlier. Kevin Powell stuck around a little bit later tonight. Powell at the Park is the podcast, which is great, man. And you can find that here, WGNradio.com, but also iTunes, all that kind of places.
Yeah. Rick Hahn on the most recent episode.
There you go.
Good stuff there. Appreciate it. Let me plug that. Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can hear Kevin, of course.
Baseball's back, baby.
Baseball is back. A week from now will be the Major League Baseball. It'll be on. So, all right. So let's talk about the Cubs and the Sox. Let's start with the Cubs.
Cool.
A good spring training for them. I mean, for all the eyes here at this station, of course, but also in Chicago on the young players that are on the White Sox and all that. A pretty limited and mild spring training for the Cubs, yet they were the best. They didn't lose at all.
Yeah, well, for the Cubs spring training, I mean, it was very, being around them for a couple weeks, it was very businesslike, and it wasn't stiff by any means, because if Joe Maddon's your manager, it's not going to be stiff and overly serious, but it certainly felt different this year compared to this time last year. You know, they were coming off the World Series, so I wouldn't say they weren't focused, but there's just something different, a little bit different about, I think the players respect how much the Cubs front office does in terms of adding talent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look what they did. Chatwood was a great value signing as a fifth starter, and then they go spend $120 million to get Darvish when most teams aren't spending pretty much any money this offseason. So I think that the Cubs players appreciate that. They get that. So I think that, you know, to me, it's as if they needed any sort of extra motivation or wake-up call. That's kind of what it is. It's like, okay, all right, this is awesome. We have you, Darvish, who's going to be like our third or fourth starter.
You got Darvish and Chatwood. You talked about the additions to this team. The course, the big minus that won't be here this year is Jake Arrieta, signed with the Philadelphia Phillies. Yeah. Joe Maddon's made a ton about team chemistry, about these guys getting along. You, Darvish, comes in. Darvish spent most of his years in Texas. He went to the Dodgers and played for the rent-a-player last year for the World Series. But how does he fit in? I mean, and also, is there a dynamic you have to think about by losing Jake Arrieta? Because he was the face, and he seemed to get along with the players. I mean, he was always front and center when it came to, like, the PJ thing or wearing your pajamas, the stupid stuff that the Cubs would do.
Yeah, I think that Arrieta absolutely had a voice. You know, I always say this, and I've said this a million times, that Anthony Rizzo is the face of the Cubs. He's the heart of the Cubs, all those sorts of cliches you want to throw out there. But when you were in the Cubs clubhouse last year, in the past couple of years, really, the guys that had the most presence, when you knew that if they were going to talk, everyone was going to listen. And that was the one wing of the Cubs clubhouse, which was John Lester, John Lackey, and Jake Arrieta. Their lockers were all next to each other. And when those guys talked, you listened. You could just tell they had a presence there. So Arrieta's gone. He goes to Philly. Lackey is not officially retired. But John Lester this spring comes in, and he's got, like, this whole different attitude, a much more of a you can tell he's been a more concerted effort by him to kind of be that veteran leader. And Maddon said it within the first week there. He's like, wow, it's so different from Lester. And it's not like some crazy, extraordinary change in John Lester. I just think Lester realizes, like, you know, maybe I should probably step it up a little bit. I'm the 32, 33-year-old veteran. I've won three World Series in my career. I should be that guy.
Right.
You know, I think the Cubs' chemistry right now is, look, they were all so young when they won the World Series. They are still so young. So
it's amazing.
When you win a World Series 2 years ago when they're all 21, 22, 23, that's a bond that's never going to be broken ever, really.
Well, this team went to the NLCS, and even they will tell you that it was a disappointing season, which is crazy to think about. They went to the NLCS. I mean, that's for a Chicago Cub team to go to the NLCS.
Third year in a row.
And be disappointed is crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of it had to do with injuries, and a lot of these young players who didn't have the kind of seasons they had before. I'm thinking about guys like Addison Russell.
Yeah, a lot of injuries to Addison Russell. I think that nobody ever wants to hear this, And I know people are going to be rolling their eyes, and I've said this 100 times since they lost game five to LA when they were eliminated at Wrigley, NLCS. Those dudes in the clubhouse looked like they could have just laid down on the ground in front of us, grabbed like a towel, and just went to bed. They were completely done. And nobody wants to hear that about professional athletes, that they were tired or exhausted. They gave it everything they had, believe me. But when you factor in that NLDS against the Nationals,
yeah,
which was intense, white-knuckle stuff for five games, then you factor in the fact to their slow start they had last year.
They had to make up a lot of ground.
They had to make up a lot of ground, which meant they were playing a lot of high-leverage, very important games, particularly against division rivals in Milwaukee and St. Louis. Remember, they clinched in St. Louis, but they had back-to-back huge series in Milwaukee, then in St. Louis. Now, they rose to the occasion.
They won those. That was amazing.
And the biggest thing for me was those were – so all those towards the end of the regular season, they had to fight to finish those guys off. Then they had to fight off Washington in five games. So I totally get it. They were gassed. They were done in the NLCS. But one of the biggest things that that those stressful games impacted on the team was the bullpen. The bullpen was throwing a ton of like high leverage innings and a lot of innings in general. That made it tough for the Cubs. We saw that in the NLDS, and then by the time the NLCS rolled on, everybody was just gassed. So I don't know where we started with this little tangent of mine.
No,
now,
but it's interesting.
I just think that it's a different mentality, and you said like they were upset about the NLCS. I think like they were all like, damn, I can't believe we went back to the NLCS in some ways, like factoring in everything.
Well, think about it. The years before, and Schwarber was hurt, but you had a down year for Kyle Schwarber last year. We're found him bouncing back and forth from the minor leagues.
Yeah.
Addison Russell didn't even, I mean, I don't even think he played 100 games. This year, you're going to see, you saw, as you just mentioned, the bullpen had a lot of trouble. You're going to see this year a team that has remade the end of their bullpen with Brandon Morrow's in, Wade Davis is out, Kyle Schwarber's in camp, he's a lot thinner, Addison Russell is back at shortstop, that moves Baez to second for good. I mean, they seem to be Albert Almora plus Ian Happ. I think Joe Maddon once again is in that issue where he's got too much talent and he's going to have to struggle.
Those good problems.
But I mean, when you think about everything you just said about them getting tired, they seem to be ready, reloaded, and seem to be the favorites in the National.
100%, and there's really no holes on this roster. I can't find one. Well, I mean, at least at this point of spring, where we're about to break camp and about to kick off the season, like, you're nitpicking at this point if you're trying to find holes in the Cubs roster. The bullpen has strike throwers. That was the problem. It was guys can't throw strikes. They were walking people late. You know, I look back at this time last year, and if you looked at the Cubs rotation, there were some serious question marks about the longevity of it. Like last year, we were like, okay, this is the last year you're going to have the core guys of like Arrieta, Lackey, Lester all together, and of course you'll have Hendricks. But you look at last year's starting five, it was basically Lester, Arrieta, Lackey, Hendricks, and Brett Anderson, who was basically a flyer.
Right.
Look at the starting five this year. Find a better starting five in baseball, top to bottom.
Yeah,
Jose Quintana's their fourth starter, and Tyler Chatwood's their fifth starter, and you basically have a sixth starter in Mike Montgomery. So there's no holes there. The offense positionally is basically just going to be Joe Maddon playing whatever matchups he wants to play, and people can gripe about the leadoff spot. It doesn't really matter because they have plenty of talent. The idea of the classic leadoff man in baseball really doesn't even exist anymore. You're going to see Happ, you're going to see Almora in the leadoff spot, you're going to see Zobrist, and you'll probably see even a touch of Schwarber, depending on how his year goes.
So exciting, man.
So not a lot of holes for the Cubs. Yeah. They're dialed in, and I think starting strong for them this year will actually matter, because you looked at their slow start last year and how that impacted them down the stretch when they had ground to make up and they had to close out guys. So if they can build a little gap between Milwaukee and St. Louis and save those arms and save those high leverage games for the postseason rather than late in the regular season, I think they'll be in good
Kevin
shape.
Kevin Pohl is in studio tonight. We'll take a break. We come back, we'll talk about the Chicago White Sox and what they're doing with their 2018 season here on the Download. Stay with us. Kevin, of course, on with Ro and Anna every afternoon here in WGN, but he also covers baseball for WGN, including his podcast, Pohl at the Park. All right, so let's talk about the Chicago White Sox,
which
now, of course, here broadcast here on WGN. This is a rebuilding year. Rick Hahn Last year, they asked him a couple times about rebuilding. He's like, I wouldn't say, you know, blah. He hemmed and hawed. This year, straight out the gate, they're all on the same page.
You know what? We were talking a little bit before the segment, and I sarcastically tweeted at White Sox at Sox Fest this year. I said my goal at Sox Fest is to find the one fan who's against this rebuild and wants them to rebuild via free agency. Yeah. And I said it sarcastically, and people were like laughing, and we were all joking about it. And I found the one guy, and he's sitting right across from me. It's Justin Kaufman, host of the Download.
I have made that very public in my last couple years.
I was stunned. At first, I thought you were joshing me when you were telling me that you're not happy with the current status of the White Sox.
As a White Sox fan, I don't mind the rebuild. I just don't like losing. And you don't mind. I mean, there's a certain style of losing, but if the goal is at the beginning of camp in spring training to say we're going to lose, I don't think Cubs fans liked it at the time. I don't think White Sox fans liked it. Yeah,
maybe it worked a couple years ago. My point being
that I don't like, as a fan, I like Hope Springs Eternal. I got Chicago in my blood. You want this team to be competitive and put the best team on the field. You don't want to have holes in left field, center field, third base, catch everywhere around the board just because in 3 years it'll be good. That's my point.
Right, but if you were to sign some veteran free agent now, you could potentially be blocking a prospect of developing.
Yeah,
so that's my argument with that.
All right, let's talk about that.
Okay,
because the Chicago White Sox, they had a good camp and a lot of eyes on these guys because of all the young players and the talent that they had at camp. A lot of them back in the minors to start the season.
Yeah.
But right now, before we get to talk, let's talk about those players. But right now, I mean, are we set on what we can expect from the 2018 White Sox? Well, who's going to be playing where? Who's going to be pitching? That kind of stuff?
Pretty much. The starting five is going to feature three guys that are part of the rebuild. And Carson Fulmer actually isn't 100% a guarantee because he's had a rough spring with some command stuff, but he's likely going to be on the big league club. So your starting rotation is going to feature three guys that actually matter, three guys that probably could be here for the long term in the rotation for the future. And Lucas Giolito, who I believe
had a great second half last year,
second half when they called him up, made seven starts, I want to say, when they called him up. Looked amazing in spring training, looked great. Reynaldo Lopez has some command issues, and Carson Fulmer. Those three are the young pitchers. They're a part of kind of the tip of the iceberg of a giant crop of
prospects.
And they're up.
At least two of them are.
All three of them are going to be in the starting rotation to start the year. And then there's James Shields and Miguel Gonzalez. Miguel Gonzalez is probably a guy you just want to flip at the deadline. James Shields, maybe we can get another miracle, and he can somehow be fairly decent in the first half of the year, and the Sox can trade him and flip him for prospects. So those three of the five like actually matter. So there you have it. Like, you're going to see three guys that you're going to watch grow, you're going to watch develop, and those are three guys that actually matter in who you're watching on the field.
The other player to watch this year, of course, Jose Abreu is back with the White Sox, which is great, but Yoan Moncada, the second baseman, who was the number one prospect last year, he's the guy we got for Chris Sale.
Yeah.
He is now the full-time second baseman for this club. There's even talk of him leading off for the squad. So this is a year to watch for Yoan Moncada.
100%. I have no doubts. I have no reservations about Yoan Moncada whatsoever. I just don't know what sort of player he's going to be yet, because there was initial comps to like Robinson Cano, but I don't know if he has the power that Cano has. Not saying that's necessarily a horrible thing. You can contribute in all sorts of ways. So I don't know if he's the middle of the order type guy that's going to smack you 30 homers and have a ton of power and stuff like that and win an MVP or something along those lines. I also wasn't forecasting him being a leadoff guy, but now that he is in that spot, he says how much he loves to lead off. It makes sense. His signature at bat last year was a freaking walk. Yeah. It was a walk for the Cubs or for the White Sox.
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
he has the best eye on the Sox.
You mentioned the league has changed on who's leading off.
Yeah.
You saw the Cubs have experimented like crazy, but George Springer in Houston is a great example of these monster talents that lead off. They aren't usually the prototypical leadoff.
That's a great point. I think for the large part, of course, you don't want like some slugger who's going to slow down, you know, clog up your base paths. But the idea of like a Ricky Henderson doesn't really exist anymore. You know, I think what you want is a guy who's going to draw good at bats, get and a high on base percentage. That's the big thing of it. And honestly, in some ways, your best hitter. You can always just make an argument that your best hitter should always be your leadoff guy, because in the long run, they're always going to have the most at-bats in a full 162-game season because of the obvious, because the way the lineup works, and you're going to get four or five minimum at-bats per game. But at the same time, there is something to be said about putting a guy second or third. I mean, the Cubs have Bryant second for a reason, because you're getting him more at-bats throughout the year. He's not necessarily your leadoff guy, and I don't think they're even going to screw around with that. So Moncada, to me, feels like a leadoff or a two guy. I'm totally fine with it.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these youngsters. There are two players. I mean, there are so many prospects in the Sox system.
Yeah.
Robert is one of which we won't see, 19-year-old kid out of Cuba. But the two that we may see this year, Eloy Jimenez, the left fielder we got for Jose Quintana from the Cubs, but also Michael Kopech, the hard-throwing, 100 miles per hour, real star of spring training. Everybody,
monster.
Everybody in baseball is watching this kid.
Yeah.
And there are projections that he might be the quote-unquote Chris Bryant rule this year, where you get to May and they now get that extra year of control.
Right.
And it's Michael Kopech time. Do you think we'll see Michael Kopech in the rotation this year?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll see Kopech as long as he stays healthy and stays on track. The big thing for him is, you know, you see these guys who are flamethrowers and they come through the lower systems and they know they can just throw it past everybody. So the big thing is developing a third pitch, which is a changeup for him, because it's a big difference between pitching and throwing. Throwing, you can go up there and throw it 100 miles per hour, throw a little breaking ball.
But someone's going to hit it 500 feet.
Someone will pick up on it. In the big league, somebody absolutely will. So right now they have him working on his changeup. He also pitched the most amount of innings last year of his entire life. He pitched 130 innings, which was 50 more than what he had thrown the previous season. So I think you're going to see that kind of factored in. He threw 130-ish last year. They're probably looking at like 170 to 180 innings.
So he'd be the target where they did that with Giolito in Washington, where they kind of shut him down at a certain point because they're like, hey,
yeah,
you don't have to play.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point.
There's no point. He's on a pitch limit.
Yeah, so I think you'll see him probably, let's just say June-ish for him. And then Eloy's going to start probably in AA, and I think he's going to, you know, after a couple weeks, they're going to be like, okay, this isn't fair for the rest of the rest of the players in this league. Let's get him to AAA. And then I think Eloy Jimenez, to me, is just MVP-type stuff, because he has the power in the bat to put up MVP-type numbers, 30 and 100-plus, crazy numbers. I feel like he has respect like around the league already. People are in an awe of this guy. Yeah. So look for Eloy Jimenez. And I will throw one other name out there for you. Dylan Cease was also part of that Cubs trade. It was Quintana to the Cubs for Cease and Eloy Jimenez. Man,
he had a great spring.
And in Rick Hahn, sorry to shameless plug my podcast, but I was talking to Rick Hahn, and I asked him about Cease, and he said Cease has as high as an upside as anybody in their system, including Michael Kopech. So high praise for Cease, and when I saw Cease up close, I was like, man, this
is
some serious
stuff. You could see with Kopech and Cease, if they both come up at some point, you could see all five of the starting pitchers that are young and part of these prospects playing.
Yeah,
and the journeyman part of the Sox last 5 years is done.
Right, right. And who knows if that'd be set, because rotations are crazy and injuries happen, and they still have a whole bunch still in the – Dane Dunning, Alec Hansen, the list goes on and on. So, You're going to see some real glimpses of the future.
All right, you convinced me.
All right? You in on the rebound? Okay.
I'm always in on the rebound. I'm always in on the Sox.
I made him a believer.
I just like to see them compete this year.
All right, I'm with you, man. It's going to be fun. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
His podcast, Powell at the Park, can be found, of course, on iTunes, but also through WGNRadio.com, and you can hear him every afternoon with Ro and Anna. Thanks, bud.
This is fun. Let's just talk baseball for another 3 hours. Is that fine?
I would do it. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Cindy Wilson from the B-52s is going to join us. She, of course, the B-52s, celebrating 40 years since their hit Rock Lobster. That's amazing to think about, but that's 40 years ago. We'll talk with Cindy Wilson. She's coming to Beef Kitchen. She's got a solo career, which she's really taking off in the, I guess it's a contemporary dance genre, dance music. There you go. Also coming up, we got some Margaret Glaspie's going to be here, which I'm excited about. She's a tremendous singer-songwriter from Brooklyn. And also David, I got to get the name right, Lau Pepe, right, from Gang of Youths, another band that's coming through town that just got announced that they're going to be at Lollapalooza. So yes, we have some great stuff coming up here on the program tonight after 9 o'clock. It's now it's time for the thrilling conclusion of a story we talked about earlier in the month, and it was all about the judges. It's tonight, part two of our convo. The first part was all about who he recommended and why these recommendations matter. And tonight we follow up to see if Cook County voters did their duty. D'Artesia Pitts is the president of the Cook County Bar Association, one of the oldest bar associations made up of African-American lawyers in the country. Founded back in 1914. D'Artesia Pitts, welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's get right to the question everybody wants to know, and that's, did we follow your recommendations? You know, when we get to the results of the primary on Tuesday, I guess I asked the question, you know, you had a list of highly recommended, recommended, and not recommended. How did we do?
I think that the voters were educated going into the booths, and I think that the results of the election showed that they did their homework.
Really?
Yes.
So you see more people making the right choices, and it looked like from the data that a lot of the bar associations that gave not recommended mm-hmm. to judges, those judges did not get on the ballot.
Yes, and I think that it's not
for
about
the general, yeah.
You know, not about the right choices. The bar associations want to make sure that the voters have information to make the best decision for themselves.
Right.
And we give that guidance with the ratings, whether they're qualified or not. So our not recommended is related based on their qualifications and that criteria that we talked about previously.
Yeah, and I find it interesting because you'll hear after every election, and this is something that's been going on for years here in the Chicago area, and it's not just here, it's everywhere around the country, but you'll hear like that voters are ignorant when it comes to judges, and more often than not, people who are not fit to be on the bench get elected again because people don't know any better. They just hit the you hear that story over and over and over. Do you see it changing? I mean, as Cook County right here in the primary, as you just said, most of the associations that said not recommended, they didn't win.
Yeah, they didn't win. I think that, like I said, I think the voters are actually doing their research. Google makes it so easy. Information is so accessible. They can pull up the information, review, research, look at people's websites, look at their records, and make better decisions going into the voters'
group. All right. And of course, there's still the general election coming up here in November. One thing I want to ask you about, D'Artesia, and we didn't talk about this last time, and I kind of kicked myself in afterwards, but I wanted to ask about representation, diversity representation, both when it comes to race and gender mm-hmm. on the benches in the Cook County. Mm-hmm. Is this an issue for Cook County? I mean, are you seeing, do we have a more diverse bench here in a county that is one third white, one third black, and one third Latino? Are you seeing that represented in the courts?
Absolutely not. I think that I want to give Cook County credit. I think that it has gotten better over the years, but the practice of law in general has been predominantly white men. So as, you know, time goes on, the practice is becoming more diverse. So you see the sprinkling of diversity happening within the judiciary, but we do have some work to do.
But when you talk about the actual bench, the judges who are elected even, right. It is predominantly white men.
Yes. It's expensive. that's, you know, judicial financing, you know, campaign financing
to run a campaign,
that's expensive. And experience, sometimes getting past us, those people who are rating you, can be a problem as well. So it just really depends.
You know, I wonder about it too, because when I think about this system, and there's been a lot of head scratching in the last couple of days about mm-hmm. how judges are elected, because again, we have a closed primary in Chicago in the Cook County and state of Illinois. And in doing so, that means that if I pull a Republican ballot or if I pull a Democrat ballot, I get those choices for judges.
Right.
I don't see the other side. Right. And there is a part of me that goes, well, why am I voting for a politician for governor or a politician for secretary of state and a politician for judge? I don't understand why it's played out that way. And I guess the question I ask here is that something that's concerning? And what are the alternatives if it's not through political party, two-party system to elect our judges?
Well, we could totally take our judges off of a political system, period, right? But then that goes back to what we talked about before, statutory changes. So that when we select or elect our judges, the judges are just thrown into one big, you know, gumbo, and then you select that way as opposed to them being divided mm-hmm. into any party. One of the ways that they've tried to resolve that, kinda, is by the creation of the sub-circuits. And the sub-circuits will create more diversity with race, with gender, as well as with party affiliation.
How do they do? Why does the sub-circuit do that?
So sub-circuit breaks the entire county down into smaller districts or smaller okay. sub-circuits. So depending on where you are, you might actually, in some of the western suburbs, be able to get elected as a Republican judge if that is the makeup of your community and your immediate demographic. But I don't know if that
No, but that makes a lot of sense to me because, mm-hmm. again, I guess it's the layman in me, and I'm right. ignorant to how this all plays out. I'd be the first to say that right. I lead with my curiosity. I don't have a lot of institutional knowledge on how we got here and why right. we do it this way. But it does seem strange to me that politics is injected into our judicial system because of the fact that at the end of the day, I think we all, everyone listening right now, would think that you'd want your judge to be fair and impartial and not necessarily in line with the party ideals of one way or the other.
I agree with you. And actually, that's why it's so difficult to go to a judicial candidates forum. They can't talk about anything. You ask them, well, what are your, you know, objectives, or what do you base your election on? What are your motives? Why are you running? To be a fair, you know, impartial, good judge with a great temperament. You know, they give the cookie cutter answers
yeah, right.
because there is a standard by what we're looking for in a ideal judge. And I do agree actually with you that it does kind of, you know, confuse the process. Is already confusing
right, right.
as it is
right.
And then they're divided into political parties and say, hey, what if you are actually a Green Party candidate?
Yeah.
You know, that so it just really throws everything off, and that is why it's so important. Those ratings are important, because what happens is the ratings, we're looking at the qualifications. Do they have the knowledge? We can't even really judge them. We can't judge the judges on their views because they're not supposed to share them. We just want them to be fair and impartial. I'm not exactly
it's so
sure.
Strange. It's so strange, too, because they don't share their, you know, their views, but yet they're running in a two-party system. They're one way or the other. So
right.
I don't know. It just seems to me that is a archaic way to think about the way we do judge or put people on the bench to decide important issues in our area.
I agree with you.
But what I love is, you know, even talking about this, is that the other option, selection, that doesn't work.
Right.
Because selection, essentially, who's selecting?
Well,
does that politicians? We see this at the federal level where they will appoint judges, and then it becomes even so blatant on both sides where the political parties say we have to win this time around so we can put our judges in.
Right.
And it just seems to me that it's just all so selection is not necessarily any better or than election.
Not at all. And the Illinois Supreme Court makes the appointments and they make the selections for the statewide, countywide vacancies.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also a process where you can become an associate judge. And the associate judges, they're not what they consider full circuit, but they apply to be a judge. And then the full circuit judges, the ones who were elected by the people, they then vote on who they want to serve as an associate judge.
Man.
So that's an entirely different process of selection. So that, yes, that also is very political. Whether you're putting a political party name on the candidate or not, relationships, networking, that
yeah, favoritism, all that
absolutely.
Kind of stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, my last thought, and you know, and I thank you for being here. D'Artesia Pitts,
no
back for part two of our conversation about the Cook County judges. She's the president of the Cook County Bar Association. But the Cook County Bar Association, reading more about the association, its history, I mean, really came together in the late 19th century, was founded and formally in 1914. And you can understand why you would want African-American lawyers to create a bar association, because we all know the sordid history in the United States of America that comes to, you know, being fair and equitable, especially when it comes to minorities in this mm-hmm. in this country. In 2018, you would think there would be less of a need for a Cook County Bar Association because we have grown so much as a society, as you can see me put a smile on my face. But the point being that do you have to think about those issues when it comes to impartial or equitable and issues of being fair as a judiciary, because when it comes to things like race and comes to this idea of making sure that everything is fair and impartial in 2018?
Absolutely.
Or impartial, yeah.
We live in Chicago, or I live in Chicago, and they say that Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the country still to this day. And part of sitting on that bench and having the honor to sit on that bench is to be able to make a decision based on experience and being compassionate to the litigants that are before you. And there are some people, there are some lawyers who they don't understand the experience of diversity.
Was a part of their life.
It's not even necessarily a bad thing. It's just their experience. Diversity on the bench is important so that you can have the compassion for the litigants before you. And considering that the courtrooms, if you go to 26 in California, and I hate to say this, but if you go to 26 in California, you would think that no white person in the city of Chicago has ever committed a crime. There are black and brown people there. And that's why it's important so that you put judges on the bench that look like the litigants, that can understand the societal issues that they're dealing with.
Right. And that's important for any judge. Dartesia Pitts is the president of the Cook County Bar Association. As we did part one, we did part two to wrap up. It's good to hear that the electorate came through here in Cook County, and we did follow the recommendations, and the not recommendeds didn't do well. But there's still a long way to go, and look forward to continue the conversation. Dartesia, thanks for being here.
No problem. And the generals are coming up. They'll all be Democrats. They'll be running uncontested.
See? I like having Dartesia in. That's an interesting conversation. I think we could open that up and have a larger, more philosophical, convo question about the idea of what experience means. You know, that might be experience when you have a lot of time being a judge, or you went through a lot of law school, or you tried a lot of cases. But I do buy the fact that experience is also, if you grew up in an area that you never were surrounded with certain types of people, and yet then you're the judge and you're handing down sentences to certain types of people, I feel like that affects your impartiality. I think you're not well-rounded enough to understand that there are different certain life experiences and environmental experiences that are going to shape why that person is in front of you. And that has been the issue with our justice system for a long, long time. So there's some Texans come in who, say, get over the skin color crap, or this conversation is racist or whatever. It's like, what are you talking about? No one is suggesting that there needs to be any one way or the other, change in the system. But you have to recognize that if you go down, like she said, if you go down to 26 in Cal, 90% of the people that go in front of judges are black and brown. So you would automatically, I think any rational person would scratch head and go, that seems out of whack. It doesn't seem like there's something off there. So you have to have judges who can understand that. But I also think that diversity and experience is also political. Meaning, it can't have a county where it's all Democrats. If you're going to have elections, you can't have a county where it's like they just got through the primary and now they're unopposed. That's totally ridiculous. You wouldn't accept that in any situation, one party or another. So I think that there's a lot we could do to get past this idea that we have to, that the politics are involved in the judicial system as well. That's right. I'm going to save the world. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is playing at Beat Kitchen coming up on the 29th of March. Chicago, put your hands together for the B-52's Cindy Wilson. You are Wilson and the B-52s are rock and roll royalty, pioneers when it came to American new wave music. The B-52s started their career back in the mid to late 70s, then bursting on the scene with hits like Rock Lobster and, of course, a decade later, Love Shack. Rock Lobster was put out in 1978, 40 years ago this year. Hard to believe. Cindy Wilson was a founding member of the group that put Athens, Georgia on the map. And just in the last few years, Wilson has embarked on a solo career. Her debut album, Change, came out last year, and it showcases Wilson's vocal chops as well as a contemporary dance sound. And like I said, the legend is playing at Beat Kitchen coming up on the 29th. Cindy Wilson, a pleasure to welcome you to The Download tonight. Cindy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's great to talk with you. First, I just ask, you know, we're WGN in Chicago. I would think that you have a lot of memories of playing Chicago at the B-52s and touring the country so many different times. What are your memories of playing in this town?
Well, Chicago's been very important. Even the first time the B-52s ever came up there, I think it's a great music town. And we were traveling in my father's van, just unloading our equipment. And, I forgot the name of the club that we played there. But it was, you know, the start of something great.
I would imagine.
People had a rock up there.
I was going to say, I would imagine that the B-52s over the years, you played probably early on smaller clubs and, you know, when you were at the height of your fame playing the stadiums in this town. And, you know, and I would assume that's everywhere in your career. And talk about that, the evolution of getting to play those kind of stadiums from, you know, humble beginnings.
Yeah, well, you know, we started in the late 70s. But our biggest album was Cosmic Thing, and so we started to play from smaller venues and up to bigger venues, and it was amazing, but it was very hard, you know, because that was very transitional days because Ricky had passed away and Keith took up the music writing, but it was some fabulous, fabulous days, you know. It just made us pull together as a band. And I think it was a really interesting time as well.
To embark on a solo career and to listen to the record, which is great, and to listen to the dance sound that you're putting together. What draws you to that kind of dance, the contemporary dance sound, the more electronic sound that we're hearing with the debut album that's out now?
Well, I like the more modern sound that's going on, which has come back around to kind of electronic and also borrows from other things, you know, which makes a real modern sound. And I also love the what they're doing when they're producing these and recording these new bands is to put a little crunch in the sound, mm-hmm. and not make it so clean that you get to play around with echoes and interesting sounds, you know. I'm loving that. I think that's so cool.
It's amazing to think about, too, because I would assume, again, that you've had a lot of experience of studio time and being in the studio with the B-52s, but also with your solo stuff. How has it changed for you? How has it evolved to make music, produce music in a studio?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's a brand new day. You know, I've made friends with other younger musicians who they're local, but they're very, you know, they're really top notch, and it was a learning experience for me. So I got to, you know, do the experimental, you know, studio thing that anybody would want to do. So it was so much fun, and I just kind of surrendered and listened to what the, you know, the younger musicians were doing. And it's a whole new game, you know, from when the B-52s started in the late 70s.
Yeah. Let's go back to the late 70s. It's amazing to think that it's been 40 years since the great music that you guys produced, of course, with Rock Lobster. It's amazing to think that that's 40 years old. That stands the test of time.
Crazy, man. I'll never forget, you know, Ricky and Keith had been in Europe, and they came back, and it'd been a while, so Ricky and I were just moving out from my parents' house, and so we got an apartment together, and I came home from the work one day, and Ricky was like, you know, on his guitar, which is not unusual, but, you know, he was just like snickering to himself. I said, what in the world? He says, it's funny, I just came up with this riff, you know. And it turned out to be the riff that Ricky used for Rock Lobster later, which is hilarious.
Wow.
You know?
To be at 40 years and to think about touring and to bring Rock Lobster back, how does it feel to go back and use nostalgia to look back 40 years from now?
Well, this is the time to do it, I think, you know. And every few years, I go back and listen to B-52s, you know, all the music we've done. And I love our music, but what's cool is I found is listening to B-sides or the stranger songs that the B-52s wrote, you know, and it blows my mind how free we were creatively and how lucky we were to bring all of our energies together and make this kind of crazy cuckoo magic, you know, in music.
What was the uniqueness about it? What do you think the magic was that made the B-52s not only break on the scene, but have this lasting power that radio stations are still playing your stuff 40 years later?
Well, it's alchemy. You know, it's a bunch of people coming in and hooking on the stream of consciousness, you know. There's something very mystical about it. But it comes from a very organic, humble place, which is just entertaining ourselves and entertaining our friends, you know. And then, you know, it kind of rolled along from there, you know. And we always try at every show to be in the moment, and it's like the very first party, you know.
Oh, wow. So, and that's a treat. It's a treat for all of the fans that have followed you guys to have that kind of experience even 40 years after Rock Lobster. We're talking with Cindy Wilson. She is part of the B-52s, founding member of the B-52s. She's going to be on stage at the Beat Kitchen coming up on March 29th. It's her solo album, her debut album, Change. How do you balance the two? Obviously, the B-52s still going strong, and the tour coming up, you know, to tour to celebrate
Culture Club.
Yeah. So how do you balance those two things, to have the creative outlet that is your solo work and creating new stuff, and go on tour with the B-52s?
We were off for a couple of years to regenerate, you know, and so I kind of spent that time just kind of experimenting with my friends, you know, and it just kind of all happened at once. We're celebrating our 41st, our 40th, or whatever, and we're playing with Culture Club, B-52s are, and I just got back on the solo tour doing some dates in Europe, and that was such an adventure. It's really, I'm just kind of thrilled about how much great stuff is going on.
You know, you've dedicated your life to music and family and others. I mean, you have been a part of the B-52s, and like you said, sometimes you guys take time off to regenerate. Now you have the solo work, and to see on the calendar that you're coming through Chicago for both of these things. How do you look back on your life in music? You know, because touring, I'm not a musician, but I know it's a grueling affair. I know that, you know, there are times that you're going city to city to city. You just talked about a European leg. There's a part of that life that is difficult, is for not for the faint of heart. So how do you see it? How do you balance life when a lot of this profession puts you on the road?
Well, it's amazing because I'm that animal, you know. I'm the animal that goes out and goes, and we do the show. We've done it since I was 20, you know, and now I'm 61. It blows my mind, you know, and I'm just a, you know, the gypsy.
Well, my last question is really just about, I was talking to Pete, our producer, and talking about how the B-52s have almost surpassed music in the way that now it's a cultural, you remember it as a cultural thing. And also I think of Love Shack as a song that gets played at my cousin's wedding. It's the kind of thing that song and the B-52s are synonymous with generation after generation after generation. It's not just one moment in time that only one generation of music listeners know about it. So how do you look back on that? How do you feel about the way that people have attached to your music and how it has lived on and permeated itself in so many different cultural ways?
I mean, I'm amazed and I'm grateful. And it was really crazy how that song came about, you know, and how it hit a nerve, you know, with the audience, you know. So it's a wonderful thing that we can be part of people's happy times. I think that's wonderful.
Cindy Wilson is going to be on stage at the Beat Kitchen coming up on the 29th of March. Her solo album, Change, came out last year, but she'll be on stage performing her solo hits. And also, she'll be touring with the B-52s, founding member of the B-52s, with Culture Club coming up this summer. Cindy, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, so Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, coming up 9:30. I'm good. I'm excited about this next one. Gangs of Youth, Gang of Youth, band at Subterranean coming up. Just got announced they're going to be at Lollapalooza. David Laupepe, Leo Pepe. I'm working on his last name, but he is in the band Gang of Youth. Tremendous. Listen, I had the best day today, Pete, listening to all the music that's on this show. It was so fun, and this band, Gang of Youth, is, I mean, they are on track to be stars, if they're not already. They've won a ton of awards in Sydney, Australia. They're now located in London, and David and company are on a U.S. tour. They were just on Seth Meyers last week. They got in the news because they've had a pretty tough tour here when they got their van broken into and all their laptops stolen. But anyway, coming to Chicago, coming up here, and, of course, Lollapalooza. That's coming up here on The Download, so stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is going to be in Chicago a few times in 2018, whether it's Subterranean in Wicker Park on the 30th or Lollapalooza this summer. You'll want to get out and see Sydney, Australia's Gang of Youth. Band now based in London is tearing it up this year with an American tour right now, and of course the big news that they'll be back in Chicago and Lollapalooza in August. The band's touring to promote their latest album, Go Farther in Lightness. The indie rockers just played South by Southwest, and they made their U.S. television debut on Seth Meyers earlier in the month. And like I said, we'll be at Subterranean Wicker Park coming up next Friday night. David LaPepe is the frontman for the band, and he joins me now. Dave, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, mate. Good to be here.
Chicago means a lot to your band, but also you have been through this town. Talk about what it means to be not only playing Subterranean coming up, but to be on the bill at Lollapalooza.
Oh, man. So our keyboardist, guitar player, Jung, was born in Chicago. He was born in the Chicago metropolitan area. And the first time he'd ever been back in 12 years was the night we played at Schubert's. It's a pretty important city for us. Yeah, it's like the epicenter of all the music that we really love, too. So one of my favorite albums is made in Chicago. So it's a pretty important place for us, I guess, spiritually and historically. We didn't think we'd ever make it to a U.S. festival, let alone the big one. So it's pretty cool.
You know, you're on an American tour right now. You know, I'm so interested because it's a very interesting tour, because reading all about, you know, you had problems with the guitar, you guys, your van got broken into in Nashville. But at the same time, yeah, the stories, I mean, you guys are just tearing it up. Everywhere you go, people are excited about the shows. You're sold out. It's kind of contrast in the way that there are things that go wrong. But at the same time, you're having one hell of a tour.
It's kind of a nice little microcosm, like a little allegory for life, though, right? Yeah, yeah. I guess punctuating all the moments of triumph, there are moments of great disappointment, and kind of like it's a strange contrast for us, but I think we've kind of put up with a lot of strange stuff over the past 6 years and a lot of adversity, so this is kind of just taken in stride for us. It's not really a huge thing. I mean, the only thing was a bunch of stuff for album 3 got stolen on one of the laptops that was taken from our van, so it's kind of back to square one in that regard, but it's all right. Interesting that people actually care about us, which is something that we're not used to in America.
Obviously, the Go Farther in Lightness, the album, is so impressive, and it's got such great reviews. But also, there is a tremendous interest in, when you talk about adversity, your story, and it goes back, and people can find it online, but at such a young age, you face such adversity. When things like this happen to you, where you have to go back to square one with the record, or you have to deal with the fact that you got robbed, or stuff breaks on tour, you do have a life perspective on this.
Honestly, it's just part of the it's just part of the fabric of what makes a life interesting and unique and important. And I think triumph over adversity and this sense of Nietzschean overcoming is kind of woven into the fabric of what we are as a band. And all these kind of moments of futility and strangeness and all these kind of tumultuous beginnings manifest in something kind of important at the end, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm not the kind of person who thinks that the loss of this material, for example, or album 3, is a bad thing. It just gives me an opportunity to refine what was kind of there present, you know, within my mind's palette, and try to pick the stuff that was actually okay and ignore the stuff that was garbage. Because I'm a big believer in, like, if it sticks with me for like more than 2 weeks, it's probably usable. So it's not like a huge deal. I just feel like the uniting human experience, the sense of loss, grief, anxiety, displacement, a sense of loneliness is really bonding. Even the small kind of seemingly first world moments of grief that we experience are uniting in a way that most other things aren't. So, you know, it's a learning experience, it's a learning curve, but we kind of try to be interchangeable with that and try to be adaptable.
Yeah, and, you know, just make a transition to the music, because all of the things that you're just talking about when you're talking about adversity, and I think of the music, and it's so expressive. The song's about love, but they're also about pain, they're about empathy. You know, you've had such life experiences at such a young age. Where do you draw your songwriting from? Where does it come from? Does it have to be a life lived before you can pen it and put it into song?
I've always said that I'm probably better at documenting the comings and goings and ins and outs of my own personal experience rather than being a strictly off-the-basis songwriter. You know, I quite envy people who are able to just pull something out of their soul at any given moment. For me, I'm not very prolific, and it takes me a long while to be able to kind of concoct or conjure up anything worthwhile songwriting-wise, because, yeah, I have to kind of live it. I have to experience it firsthand. You know, I'm not one of those people who takes the Kierkegaardian adage lightly. You know, like, I believe that life is a reality to be experienced, you know, and I am better at documenting that than I am at just kind of being able to wave my hands and make something beautiful. So I think there's an element of slow pace within the confines of what I do, but it all kind of has to come from somewhere. And I think that's where a lot of the great, honest songwriting kind of came before me. And I'm not kind of like I don't want to be pretentious about it, but I am a believer in writing things that are human and relatable and ambitious. Yeah. I don't think I'm able to do that without a sense of respect for my life experience and my respect for my my context. Maybe that's a rare thing, but I don't know.
It totally makes sense too. And it also plays, as you mentioned, that slow pace. And I want to ask you about this. Yeah. There really is a patient feel to the record and to the music and a diversity, but it's a diversity of sound, meaning you'll have one song that is that sort of arena rock, that kind of, you know, you guys are really, sort of, and then at the same time, you can have this beautiful strings rendition of Guns N' Roses, or you're able to slow it down and do just stuff that is really melodic and patient. How important is it when you guys set out to put a record out to think about the pace, to think about diversifying the songs that you put on the album?
We don't want to make anything that doesn't feel like it's the most important thing we've ever made. And I think the ambition to create bodies of work that are significant to us in the hope that they could be significant to other people is the prime motivation. And I think our record, Godfather and Lightness, is probably a really good distillation as to who I am as a person. I'm someone you need to be quite patient with. And I'm long-winded and drawn out, and occasionally too mouthy and wordy and prone to navel-gazing. So 77 minutes, I think, is a long time to expect of anybody in this day and age. But I believe wholeheartedly, if you require a great deal of patience, you better return the favor, and you better return something worth being patient for. And I feel like in terms of the architecture of our opus, you know, the architecture of our pieces of work, we do endeavor to create things that feel like a great labor of love, that feel like it had some significant moments of thought put into it, that it's not just an afterthought thought, it's not just some kind of cynical gesturing, you know? And I think there's a lot of conjecture right now about whether or not albums are as important as singles, and, the market's probably saying no, they're not, but I'm a firm believer in not capitulating to the whims of the market, but, you know, attempting to, like, restore to people who want to listen something valuable in their listening experience, you know, something that requires a great deal of immersion and respect, and I really like that, you know? It might not be for everyone, but it's something that I care about.
And you feel it, too, and that's what really grabs the ear as well. The strings, you've arranged the strings, and I guess my final question is, and you see more and more of the reviews that come out, and people have seen you on tour, this tour, a lot of people say Gang of Youths are destined for arena rock. They're destined to be on the big stage, you know, playing the Lollapaloozas of the world from here on out. When you talk about, you know, pushing back against what the market wants, do you see your band going in that direction? Do you see yourself finding a niche on the big arenas of the world as opposed to the more soft and patient and beautiful stuff that we've been hearing from Gang of Youths?
Oh, man. Do I envision us in arenas? No, but I'd like to play every room like it was an arena. I think the audience deserves that, and I think that's how I wanted to spend my life. I always think about the great hardcore punk bands. I always think about the great post-hardcore punk bands. I always think about Cro-Mags. I think about Combat Kid. And I think about Fugazi. I think about the bands that played as if they were playing for the world, but they were playing with 20, 30 kids. I think that's the great pursuit of what it is to make redemptive, meaningful rock and roll. Do I think we'll be on an arena? No, but I would like to play as if I am in one, because I genuinely believe in the redemptive power of rock and roll music. I think it's a transformative art that's been kind of wasted the past 20 years, and I would like to, you know, make my life mean something in that regard and return it to some sense of atoning glory. That's what I want. So I don't know if that means arenas, but dude, if it's like 30 people, I don't care. Joy Division started in a room of 20 people at Manchester City Trade Hall at Sex Pistols. I don't care. It can't really be about us and what we want anymore. It's about, like, I don't know, it's about Pacific Islander kids in Australia or Black and Aboriginal kids in Australia seeing, you know, people our color making rock and roll music. It's about doing something that's meaningful to us, that we care about, because I believe I was put on the earth for some reason, even if it's a small one, and that's to kind of destroy apathy wherever I find it. That's just what I want to do.
No, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. The band Gang of Youths is going to be at Subterranean coming up on the 30th, and then Lollapalooza this summer. David Laupepe is the frontman for the band Gang of Youths, and he took some time out tonight. I appreciate it, David. Thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, man, and you actually nailed the pronunciation of my last name, so well done.
There will be no years of silence in the shadow of regret. I won't let a soul betray me, though my soul got used to it. I will look at love as more than just an instrument of pain, and will give myself completely to the moving and the strange. Cause I will not hurt like this forever. I'm responding to the call.
favorite song. I will not play this out discreetly. It is real and unashamed. I am human now and terrified, but one and all the same. Cause heart is a muscle, and I wanna make it strong. The heart is a muscle now.
As we've been saying tonight, shoving a lot of stuff in because Pete and I, we're out. We got a week off, spring break. Coincides with these schools, of course. I'm going out west. Gonna see if there's gold in there, them hills. Those Disneyland hills.
Ah, Disney.
Yeah, heading out to Disneyland with the family and the grandparents.
Oh, that's a,
yeah.
This is a family trip.
I finally figured this out. I you know what? You're going to love this, Pete. You're going to love it. My wife, you know, a lot of times you can get a very stressful kind of vacation going, when you're trying to, you know, make sure that everybody's having a good time. And especially when you have different needs for different people.
Yeah.
You know, 10-year-old and you got a 75-year-old, right? And there's a lot of walking and organizing and making sure everything's okay. And I actually like it on the ground. What I don't like is the planning and all that kind of stuff of dealing with the tickets and all that kind of, it's just not something, I'm not a good attention to detail on that. I get focused on what I have to do in the moment, but I'm not very good at organizing and planning something to be perfect 3 weeks down the line. And we were talking the other night and we totally nailed it. A great analogy. My wife, she's the executive producer.
Mm-hmm.
She sets the agenda. She's the one, like, the big... And I'm the floor director. It's my job in the moment.
Putting people where they need to go.
I am responsible for the execution of the moment.
You get the rundown.
Right.
And then you do...
Maybe I make the rundown. Her job, she's the overall. We're going to Disneyland. This is the tone that we want from Disneyland. Mm-hmm. This is what we're going to try to do. We got to make sure that this is friendly for walking, but also that the sun can get all the roller coasters, and it's all got to work out. And I go, sounds good. You know, like I got the marching orders. I'm like, it's perfect. All
right. I'll be there.
Yeah, I'm the leader in the moment.
And then when that happens,
right? I'm also putting people
in the right spots.
I got to put people in the right spots. I have to execute the game plan.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the point guard. She's the coach. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and I feel more empowered. I know it sounds strange, but I feel more empowered, like I have a role and a responsibility, as opposed to being the guy who's like, okay, this is in the back. I'll just be back here. You know? Or like have to take, you know, the gender roles and be like, I'm the dad, so I'll do that. You know, I'll drive the car. I'm not going to check for directions. Mm-hmm. No, now I know my role. I feel good about it. I feel really good about it. I feel like
to go into this relaxed.
Yeah. And I like that. I like
taking the stress away.
I like, can we get the Space Mountain and Thunder Mountain? How are we going to do this? It's on me. I like that, right?
Yeah.
And I also feel like the only thing I have to set up, I have to figure this out over the weekend before we go, is just the executive producer can't start micromanaging.
Oh.
They can't, like, in the moment become the floor director. The coach can't go out there and be like, look, get out of there. Give me the ball. Right? You have to be aware that that's my job and my responsibility. You can give me a bad grade and a bad review and dock my pay when we get home. But in the moment, you can't micromanage, right? I mean, that's what I have to figure out, how to make sure that there's not a veto power in there for the executive producer.
Yeah, who's the boss? Like, who would be considered the boss of the whole operation?
Oh, absolutely. She's the boss of the whole operation.
Okay.
But I like the coach point guard analogy because the coach can't go on the field. You know, they can't go on the court. You know, he or she can call timeout and say, do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't say, give me the ball. I'm in.
Right.
So that's the idea, that she can't do that stuff. Like, that's mine. If she doesn't like, she can call a timeout. She could pull me to the side. Whisper during the free throw.
this is what I need you to do on the next play. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I was just worried that if, you know, like you were the boss overall, there'd be, you know, we'd get a memo saying, you know, the executive producer of the Coffin Vacation has been replaced.
Right. no comment. Yeah, or what's the like the statement that's real quick and cursing, like, you know, like he's been replaced. He will not be.
We appreciate the job that she has done these last 2 days.
No, I'm excited about it, though. I feel like my goal is to get the app, and I have to figure out the game plan. Like, where do you get in? Where's the monorail? When do we go to this ride? How do we get across the way? What's the plan? Where do we have to go? When do we eat? When do we? And I have to pay attention to that stuff. I'm excited, right? I think I can do it.
That's a lot of work, though.
It is a lot of work, but I don't mind doing the work, and I look forward next week to letting you know how it went.
All right.
Yeah. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on the 3rd of April, you probably want to make your way to Evanston Space for a great lineup, a great night of music. The headliner, none other than New York-based singer-songwriter Margaret Glaspy.
Oh, when I got you by my side, everything's alright. It's just when you're gone I start to snooze the alarm, cause I stay up until 4 in the morning, counting all the days till you're back, shivering in an ice cold bath of emotions and mad. Oh, it's a shame. Alright, until you go and I start losing control without a warning, counting all the days till you're back, shivering in an ice cold bath of emotions and life. I've gotta get out of this tree, off of this limb. I'm a woman acting like a kid, a skinny mess that's breathless from telling you all of the things that I'm gonna do.
Margaret Glaspy is the real deal. Her songwriting and her unique guitar sound have been turning heads for a couple of years now. Her 2016 album, Emotions and Math, was well-received, ending up on many of the end-of-the-year best-of lists. Just, that was the title track we just heard. And just this month, she surprised the music world with a new set of songs, an EP called Born Yesterday. Take a listen to the single, Before We Were Together.
Shut my eyes, I don't want to be privy to the look you're giving me when I tell you that I'm never gonna be the way you said I would. Shut my mouth, I don't wanna say words that'll make you go away, but I also wanna make you go away for good. I don't like it any more than you do. I don't like being the bad guy and breaking the bad news, cause I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't say. Life was better before we were together, straight to your face. Oh, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't say. Life was better before, oh, we were together. Dark going over it, or maybe we could laugh it out, but what is there to joke about? I don't like it any more than you do. I don't like being the bad guy and breaking the bad news, cause I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't say.
Margaret Glaspie is coming to Evanston on 3rd with Buck Meek from Big Thief. But first, she's with us tonight on The Download. Margaret Glaspie, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, how often do you get through Chicago? I mean, what's it mean to be coming through and playing this town?
I love playing Chicago. It's one of my favorite cities to play. And thankfully, last year we made it through, you know, several times, which is great. So it's always good to be back. It's such a music lover city, so we always feel the love when we're in Chicago, and we're excited to be back again.
Grew up in California. You moved to the East Coast to study music. You found yourself in New York City in the Brooklyn area. Talk about that transition to go from someone who went to Boston to study music to come to New York. I mean, you have had such a tremendous schooling when it comes to both, you know, the formal schooling and the informal schooling of music.
Yeah, totally. It's been kind of a mishmash of a lot of different styles of learning, and I come from a really musical family, so that was a big source of education for me. Both my mom and my dad, super music heads, and my sister and brother are both total musicians too. So it was pretty natural to become a musician, and you know, my short time at Berkeley was total education in every way possible, and moving to New York was just the same. So I feel like I've kind of organically just kind of got to where I was, for sure.
Well, the New York scene is defined, and you know, you being a big part of it, but a lot of it is DIY. A lot of it is musicians who are pulling up by the bootstraps and doing great work on their own without the support of labels, but also not necessarily having that formal background. So let me ask, how does the Berklee School of Music and your formal background in music help you in that scene?
Really, any education you can get, if you're looking for it, it goes to good use. But if it falls on deaf ears, you know, it doesn't really go anywhere. So it was, I was hungry for it when I was there at Berkeley, and I was only there for a semester. It was very short. So it kind of just gave me a shot of formal training. But really, it was interesting because I think now that I'm not in music school, I've actually seeked the most formal training, because when I was in Berkeley, I was really, it was my first time being around so many musicians like that. So while it was kind of on paper, the more formal side, it was like actually I was, you know, away from home for the first time. I was around all these young musicians that were way better than me. It was kind of like, that almost felt like the most informal. And then now, as I kind of grow up and, you know, find my preferences and what I like to learn, now I should get lessons and, you know, kind of, you got to work to kind of get better as you kind of mosey along. Otherwise, you get bored. So.
Yeah.
Now I feel like I'm more formal than I ever was.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about your music and how you've evolved from the Emotions and Math album in 2016 to the EP that just came out. When you approach your music and approach going from project to project, is it a narrative approach? Do you think of it in a linear way where it's chapter to chapter to chapter? Or is it something that the music is inspired by what's going on at this point in your life?
Yeah, I think that in terms of just my approach to music in general, there's been like a pretty linear approach and just kind of collecting what I've been interested in and just kind of going from there. There's never been like a big game plan in terms of like what I want to achieve, and often even genre-wise, the music that I make. I think that some people kind of assume that I'm like a rock head or something sometimes, and that is kind of far from the truth. I mean, I get really inspired, and then I make music, and then I get inspired by other things, but it kind of constantly evolves into different zones pretty quickly.
How do you think the EP, the music, the songs, the three songs on the EP, how do you think they're different than the collection of songs on Emotions and Math?
I think they're different. I mean, we were on the road for about 2 years before making that EP. Really, it was the songs that I had written while on the road is the EP. So it feels very connected to Emotions and Math because it's all trio-based music. It's all out of the live setting that I played and toured that record, but it feels to me slightly, I don't know, it really kind of feels like a bookend on the record in a way, and slightly more distilled to me because it's us playing songs after I just haven't been touring for so long. So, yeah, it kind of feels like a boiled down version or something of the record.
Margaret Glaspie is my guest. She's going to be at Space coming up here on the 3rd of April. When you read a lot of articles and you read about your, even in your bio, you talk about the singer-songwriter part, it really truly is with you because you're able to craft great lyrics and hooks and melodies, but at the same time, a lot of for your guitar work. The guitar work is very unique, and it's a great combination of
almost this patient sound, but also it's got this rumble to it. Do you consider yourself, when you're kind of thinking about categories, you think yourself more of a lyricist or more of a musician?
Oh, gosh. It's a hard one to answer. I feel like songwriting is the craziest job. Being a singer-songwriter is a crazy job because you're trying to be good at a lot of things. It's a bold move to do it well. So, yeah, I mean, I think that I consider myself kind of all of the above, to be honest. I think a lot of times I consider myself a songwriter first, and then sometimes the people around me kind of nudge me and say, like, remember that you're also a musician. You're also just kind of rendering these songs all the time. So nowadays, when you're touring, you're spending a lot more time being a musician than you are, hopefully, being a musician than you are songwriting. So I think right now, while I've been off cycle for a little while, I've been staying at home and working on new songs, which has been really fun. So right now I kind of consider myself more of a songwriter, but it's hard to kind of separate the both because you got to kind of still be plugged into musicality to keep on writing good songs.
And I try to figure out the right way to say this, but there seems to be a real care for your lyrics in the production. And I wonder, because the guitar is so unique, and it also is something that really drives the music, and it can be a real big part of the music. But because you do both, do you find yourself finding a respect and a compliment to each other, meaning you don't have the guitar that overpowers necessarily what you're saying, but at the same time, your lyrics are able to bring out the best in the guitar? Does that make sense? How much care you give to the actual production and making sure that we hear what you're saying?
Yeah, I think I have a big sensitivity to it. I realize more and more, too, when I play, you know, with other people, and I've played in other people's bands and stuff, too, and I am always looking to play, kind of frame the song more than I am to be heard, but basically. I think as a musician playing songs that aren't even mine, I often want to be able to very clearly display what the message is, and sometimes that's kind of, you know, it just really depends on what the song wants. So, but I'm certainly at the school of serving the song, and I think there's a lot of different kind of schools behind, you know, how to frame a song well, or how to compliment an arrangement, or how to play well on a record. And I'm a lyricist, and so I am sensitive to lyrics and wanting them to be heard and serving them properly, for sure.
Well, it definitely plays out. A great EP called Born Yesterday just put out this month. The 2016 album, of course, was Emotions and Math. Margaret Glaspie will be on stage April 3rd at Evanston Space. I can't thank you enough for taking some time out tonight, Margaret. We appreciate it.
No, no problem at all. It's my pleasure.
Coming up, comic Vic DiBattista from New York City. This is a great story this guy's got. He's, you know, a stand-up comedian, early 80s, a lot of Italian-American jokes. He's an Italian guy. A pretty standard stand-up fare, especially for New York comics, right? He's not an alt comic. He's straight ahead. You know, the thing about growing up Italian. But he toiled away at this for a long time. Years, decades. And he wasn't really getting anywhere. He wasn't getting the calls. He wasn't the guy that was getting the sitcoms, that kind of stuff. And he put out a viral video that went fine. He didn't put it. He put out a video during Hurricane Sandy where he just took out his phone and he did it and he put it on YouTube. But he just made fun of the fact that he had to go get bread and milk because the apocalypse was coming when it come to Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it was a really funny video where he's just like, oh, I got to get the bread and milk. You can tell his wife was sending him out, got to get the bread and milk, because everyone goes to the grocery store. It went super viral. Millions and millions of people loved it. People from the area, of course, but around the country because of the hysteria that was around storms. He has been able to resurrect his stand-up career. He's going to be at Park West. He's doing tours. He's in movies now. Kevin James called him and offered him roles because of it. It's amazing to think about the little things that can happen in your career that gets you on track. So that's coming up. Vic DiBattista will be in studio, or on the phone. We'll have him on the phone. So I don't know why I just said he was in studio. But we'll talk to him about, well, he's coming to Park West, about this, the resurrection of his career. I'm looking forward to it. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is coming to the Park West next Saturday night for a night of stand-up. Chicago, make sure you get your bread and milk because Vic DiBattista is coming to town.
You know I'm Italian. I grew up in a basement. That's why I know I'm Italian. Italians don't use upstairs. That's the museum. Yeah. I didn't see upstairs. I was 5 years old. That's where the Colts went on Thanksgiving. The hell did I know? You can't use the furniture. It's all wrapped in plastic. My grandma, you expecting rain in the house? Why do you do this? Even a dog is wrapped in plastic. Let him out. Look, he's trying to bark. He's fogging up. Let him out.
Vic DiBattista started doing stand-up in New York City in the early 80s and made a name for himself in the tri-state area, but he found a much larger and worldwide audience when he went to YouTube. Right before Hurricane Sandy hit that area, Vic posted a quick clip about going to the store to get supplies.
Gotta get the bread and milk. I gotta get the bread and milk. I gotta get the bread and milk. I gotta get the bread and milk. Oh my God, I gotta get the bread and milk. 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 Oh my God. I gotta get the bread and milk. Oh my God.
That video went viral with millions and millions of hits, and Vic was able to use that to start a tremendous digital career and to boost himself into mainstream show business. He was in Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2, and he continues to get work in various films and sitcoms. The self-described working class zero, Vic DiBattista, is coming to the Park West next Saturday night. But first, he's on the line with us tonight. Vic, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, too.
You know, for you, being a New York comic, you obviously also get to get out on the road. Talk about your experiences with Chicago to come here and play Park West. What's it mean to you?
Well, you know what? I used to do it many years ago. I worked Zanies back in the late 1980s. So this is nice. You know, I finally got a nice following, and I'm looking forward to it. Hey, look, any town that Sinatra sings about is okay by me.
You have a professional stand-up, and you have grinded it out for decades. But when you come to Chicago this time around in the Park West, you're talking about a whole different thing. You have a huge following from your digital work. Talk about that.
You know, like I said, it's been a while since I've been to Chicago, and I'm really looking forward to it, you know, because basically, you know, the Northeast is a lock. I got a great following here. This is more or less like a test now to see how I'm going to do in the Midwest. And I, according to, you know, the messages and the post I get on Facebook, I think it's going to be a nice turnout. I'm looking forward to it.
To make the transition as a stand-up comedian who works rooms and really hones your craft on stages in New York City and, like you said, the Northeast, to make the transition to a digital comic, to have a YouTube channel, to do the How Long I Gotta Wait stuff or the or even the bread and milk, how easy or how hard was that to make that transition from something that you knew so well, being on stage and working a mic and working a room, to being in front of a camera and trying to connect with an audience?
Well, when Bread and Milk went viral, that's when it really started. I wouldn't be where I am right now. I wouldn't have the following without the social media. To me, it's pretty easy. You know, I walk around with my cell phone. I do a video, takes, you know, a minute, and boom, it's out there. And the social media between Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. I mean, I have more views than a sitcom would get. The past 2 weeks, I reached 14 million news feeds on Facebook alone. I'm 57, and I'm using a tool that these young comics use, you know?
I love it, because watching all your stuff today, what's great about it is that it's so many comics. You even mentioned young comics. They're trying to find their voice. They're trying to use social media to be able to put their stand-up and their comedy out. But at the same time, you need to find and craft your voice in that space. It can't just be, I've got a funny bit, I'm going to go to YouTube and see if it works. How much have you put into finding your voice in this digital space as opposed to the stage?
You know what it is? I'm relatable. I dubbed myself as, you know, the working class comic. You know, I talk about being married, having kids. Look, I'm not clever. I'm not one of those edgy comics. People will relate to me. I just put it out there, and I'm getting a huge audience that, you know, it's like the silent, I'm like the voice, the silent majority in this this world that seems confused at the moment. There's a lot of negativity. And like I said, all my stuff is positive. Another big thing is I never talk politics, which is a big mistake.
Right, right. Well, I will say, you know, it is positivity, and there's no politics. The rage and the rants, when you get mad about what went wrong with customer service, or you get mad about somebody opening their door into yours at a parking lot,
there is something relatable about it, but you're able to channel your rage in this way that it almost feels like your head's going to pop off, and it's right. All for my entertainment.
I have this anger, but yet I'm making a point, and I'm making it funny. You know, I do a character called Ticked Off Vic. That's what you're talking about, yeah. Ticked Off Vic. There's a Ticked Off Vic in all of us. You know, it's not only that. I have characters. I do this Tony Gaga. I do this guy called That Guy. He doesn't say a word. I talk about animals, which I got my cat. My cat now has fans. It's insane. You know, it's just, I'm not a one-trick pony. There's different dimensions, and that's the beauty of it. There's so much. And this doesn't even have anything to do with my stand-up.
Yeah, right.
You know, people come to my shows. They don't know I'm a stand-up comic. They think I'm going to stand there and yell out bread and milk for 45 minutes. It's amazing. The vignettes are entirely different than the stand-up. You know, before bread and milk, you know, I was a school bus driver. I drove a garbage truck. It's my story's a great story. It's been an amazing ride. You know, the fruits of my labor is finally, I'm finally enjoying it. It's you know, I'm just riding the wave.
What's great about your stand-up is that it plays a lot about you being an Italian-American. It's a lot about your growing up, the great bit on YouTube about if you're Italian, you know you're Italian because you spend most of your time in the basement. The family's in the basement.
Exactly.
My wife's family, it's like to a T. It's like the house is there, but everybody's down in the basement. but this concept that you were, before Bread and Milk, I mean, you were kind of known as a comic that, you know, Italian-American comic that is making fun of ethnicity and that kind of stuff. But how do you change your act? Do you go back to that act after Bread and Milk? Do you go, or do you have to find new stuff that's going to relate with the people who are coming after that part of your career has already played out?
Well, it's funny you said that, because now that I'm, you know, like one night I tried doing new stuff and people are yelling out the old stuff. It's like I created Frankenstein monsters. I'm on stage and they're yelling out bits now during my act. It's a compliment, but it throws me off sometimes. You know, I do old and new each show, you know, because people want the old stuff. But then again, you got to change it up. And, you know, look, I'm not going to lie. It helps if you're Italian to see my act, but you don't have to be Italian. Because, look, I'm sure every ethnic group has the plastic around the covers and the picture of Jesus Christ shaking hands with Frank Sinatra. Well, I guess Jews don't, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. I always think about it because for you to get on stage and do this, you know, reading about your story and knowing that you started in the early 80s, to have a viral sensation 30 years after the fact, in a spot where I would assume that stand-up comedy was something that was a part-time job, meaning you're finding other ways to find income like a lot of comics do as they get older. Was it tough for you to think about your career after that viral sensation to say, hey, I'm going to be a professional full-time stand-up comedian?
Well, I'm already doing stand-up full-time now, 3 years now. Literally, 3 years ago, everything was the perfect storm. I got a manager who sat me down and said, look, you don't need to drive a school bus anymore. And then Kevin James put me in Mall Cop 2, and that was another thing. And then between that, Bread and Milk, and the following and the social media, that enabled me to do this finally full time. When I drove the garbage truck, I used to drive the truck to Dangerfields in New York City. I would go on stage, do my act, get back in the truck, and finish the route. You know, I mean,
wow.
It's just incredible. It's the past 3-4 years, I would say, it's been amazing. And I'm just, like I said before, I'm just riding the wave. I just, you know, I try to put out 2 or 3 videos a day. I'm selling out clubs and theaters. They're adding shows now. I mean, I'm doing the Borgata in Atlantic City the same night. I'm sure you heard of this guy from Chicago, Sebastian Maniscalco.
Yeah, of course.
Me and him are in the same building, and I still sold out. That's surreal. Amazing. It really is.
Yeah. It's also good, as someone who follows comedy understands, that it does take a lot of work to be able to hone your craft, but also a lot of it is just persistence and perseverance, being able to be on Dangerfields and then having to go do your truck route. At a certain point, a lot of people give up the Dangerfield. Right? They say, you know what, it's not worth it anymore. But for you to have this viral success, to find a different avenue for your career, especially one that usually stereotypically is reserved for younger comics who may be more indigenous to it, it is a success story. When you think about your stand-up career, and here you come to the Park West next week, do you see it that way? Do you see the perseverance? Do you say, hey, I'm a successful stand-up?
Oh, absolutely. But now I gotta maintain it. I gotta keep going. You know, it's all how you're brought up. You know, I come from a very strict traditional Italian upbringing. It's hard work. I would do shows before. I have my own show now at the Borgata. They would book you there 7 nights. I would literally drive back and forth to the Borgata, which is an Atlantic city. I live in Staten Island. I lived in Jersey. The school bus route was in Staten Island. So I would go back and forth, Atlantic City, New Jersey, Staten Island, for 7 nights in a row. I mean, come on. It's sacrifice. I left my family on a cruise ship in Bermuda to fly back home on a propeller plane sitting next to a guy holding a live chicken to film a pilot that went nowhere. You know, you got to pay your dues. Yeah. And I'm still fighting the fight. Now I got to hit the Midwest and California. It's a lot of work to do.
Vic DiBattista is the stand-up comedian who will be at the Park West next Saturday night for a night of stand-up. Of course, Vic, a New York City comedian in the tri-state area who went viral and now has millions and millions of followers on YouTube. Vic, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us tonight. We really appreciate it.
No, thanks, Justin. And I really can't wait to taste the Chicago-style pizza when I'm there.
This is The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, Patty Vasquez coming up. Last 5 minutes till spring break for us. Very excited about that. Tomorrow's the big march for in Washington and in Chicago. I know that it's kind of set up to be a march for guns in schools or more safety for the kids because it was put together by the kids in Parkland. But I don't know. It's interesting because I interpret it in a different way as an opportunity for Chicagoans to register their protests to what has become an epidemic in this town, which is violence, gun violence, regardless if it's in your neighborhood or 10 blocks away or 50 blocks away or miles and miles away. It's something that's just unacceptable. It's unacceptable that our leaders, it's unacceptable that our criminals, it's unacceptable that our police, I mean, it falls in the leaders, that this issue, for whatever reason, in the city of Chicago, and here comes the summer, Memorial Day, 4th of July, all these areas where you're going to have hundreds of people shot and killed. It's just unacceptable. And you could argue with me and you could say, well, you know, everyone's doing their debt. It's because of this. It's because of that. It's because of this. I don't care what the reason is. I'm not interested in getting into a political argument about it. I think at the end of the day, I think we all can step back, take a deep breath and go, it's unacceptable. We can't live in a society where we let violence like this, gun violence, go unchecked. That's what this is about. And it may be affluent kids in Parkland, Florida, who are pushing the agenda for their own reasons, what happened in their high school back in Florida back a month ago. But for me, it's much more about making sure that, you know, someone is paying attention to and we don't let the same patterns continue to happen. I don't know what the answers are. I don't have the answers. But I register my protest as a citizen of the city of Chicago to say I don't want to live in a town where this is just kind of left unchecked. So I think I'll go over to Union Park and register that complaint tomorrow. Again, it's not political to me. It's not about who's in Washington or what party's in Washington. It is a blanket leadership question. I would like to see priority in this city and priority in this state. And I would like to see priority in Washington on this issue where more and more people are being affected regardless of their background, their class, their status, their race, their gender, whatever it might be. They're being affected by it. And even though I could make a strong argument that I'm that guy who it's not happening in my backyard, I don't have that in my block, it's still important to me. And I think that that's something that is worth a little bit of my time on a Saturday morning. Right?
You have from now, it starts at 11 tomorrow, right? I think. Yeah. So you have about 12 hours. To come up with a good chant.
I know. Or a sign. That's going to be the problem.
Something that rhymes.
If you don't catchy. If you don't have a chant or a sign, then you just look like an undercover cop. And I also will say that the protest is not far. I don't live that far from Union Park, so it's also a matter of convenience. Like, I know it sounds terrible, but I'm like, yeah, I definitely will. I will go down there. Oh, you got to take a bus. Nah, you know what? There's a Metro train involved. You know, I support you from Twitter. You know, like that kind of thing. But since Union Park is like a nice brisk walk, I'm like, I too will go over there. But if the protest goes downtown, I'll be like, this is where I get off. Sorry, I'm not going all the way. Yeah, I need to come up with a chant and a sign. I don't have a good one, though. You know, and I don't know if I have the time to roll over to Walgreens or the Michaels and get, you know, the real good poster board. The, like, squishy poster board. So, all right. Patty Vasquez coming up next.